I'm going to start with a zip through history, and in many respects, my talk is going to be front-loaded because the most influential academics ever were very early on. Universities predate capitalism. Under the tributary mode of production with strong states, as in China, university-type institutions served the ruling class largely by producing professional public servants and ideologists. Universities had a bureaucratic character in these sorts of societies. Under the tributary mode of production with weak states, what we commonly call feudalism, universities also served the ruling class by producing lawyers, managers, doctors, and ideologists. Ideologists with a specific bent, they were theologians. They talked about religion. And they mainly serviced the universities, feudal magnates, big aristocrats, monarchs, and so on. And the universities had a kind of a guild character, like guilds that were involved in producing leather goods and so on. These were guilds producing mines that would be of use to the ruling class. The academics who probably had the greatest radical impact ever were pioneers of Protestantism. John Wycliffe in England, 14th century Oxford University. Jan Hus in 15th century Prague, he was a Czech. And Martin Luther, who I expect most of you have heard of, in 16th century Wittenberg in Germany. All three were also priests, and their religious doctrines intersected with widespread disaffection within feudal society, because the predominant ideology of feudalism that justified the feudal order was religion. All three were what we would today call liberals, with a small L. They wanted to improve the established order rather than tear it down. But some people who drew on their ideas wanted to take them much further. John Ball, who was an important leader in the Peasants' Revolt in England, which saw a massive uprising of feudal serfs against the established order. He was also a priest, but much closer to the people. He wasn't an academic. He was a wandering preacher. It was he who said, when Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? A very, very subversive kind of idea, undermining the whole idea that the existing setup of society was God ordained. In the Czech lands, the Taborites, who drew on Jan Hus's work, set up a egalitarian society which sought to do away with differences in social status. And Thomas Münzer, during the German Reformation, went far further than Martin Luther and was an important figure in the Peasant War in Germany, about which Engels wrote. John Ball, was hung, drawn, and quartered. The Taborites were massacred after being defeated militarily, and Thomas Münzer was tortured and executed. On the other hand, Wycliffe, who had high aristocratic backers, had died a natural death. Jan Hus was a bit of a schmuck. He had major backers amongst the Czech aristocracy, but he was suckered into going to Constance, to the Catholic Council of Constance, on the basis that they would hear out his arguments and so on. Well, that was a bit of a mistake because they burnt him to death. The feudal backers of Jan Hus smashed the Taborites and their version of effectively a Protestant religion, the Utraquist Church was the main religious institution in the Kingdom of Bohemia for over a century. Luther prospered and backed the princes who suppressed the peasants' uprising in Germany. Now, while universities were and still are fundamentally conservative institutions, they have always provided some space, which a lot of people exaggerate, for critical theological, literary, or social scientific thought about society. That's an aspect of that function of helping ruling classes deal with new challenges. If all you can do is regurgitate old doctrines, you're not going to be very useful in providing advice about what to do when faced with new situations. And where academics have proposed social change, they, like the early Protestant theologians, have overwhelmingly advocated reform as opposed to revolution, and that's still the case. On to the capitalist university. There was a gradual transition from feudal to capitalist structures and ideas in society at large, but also at universities as well. And in some situations, that transition was accelerated by the activities of militant students. The decline of medieval scholasticism, the medieval outlook on the world, relied on the Bible and Aristotle. For example, the transition from that to a more modern worldview was facilitated at Leiden University in the Netherlands by the fists and sticks of supporters of Cartesian philosophy in the 17th century. That's something for students to live up to today, I think. Up until after the Second World War, we're zooming through history here, universities were elite institutions into which lucky and bright sons, hardly ever daughters, of the lower orders might be admitted. Universities trained professional labour needed by capitalists and the state. Lawyers, doctors, engineers, architects, scientists, middle managers and ideologists. And some members of the ruling class were also trained at universities, although that was not a necessity as it is not today. But universities were long organised along still largely feudal lines as kind of guilds of God professors. University research contributed to capitalists and their states' need to continually revolutionise the means of production and destruction driven by intercapitalist competition between individual capitalists and states. So universities were important for the capitalist class in producing qualified labour power, workers who could do jobs that were necessary for the system, and also for producing technologies that would be useful to particular capitals and states. Mass universities emerged after the Second World War to satisfy capitalism's new requirements, especially for more and more skilled white-collar workers, teachers and journalists and nurses, in addition to the other kinds of professions that had otherwise been produced by universities in earlier stages. Lawyers as well, not so much theologians anymore, not so important for justifying the continued existence of a class-based society. Now more students from working-class backgrounds, but still disproportionately from middle and ruling-class families, could get to university. And it was those from middle and ruling-class families who tended to monopolise the more prestigious courses. And there was a shift to more modern structures in universities, like modern public services and like large modern corporations. That process is nearing completion, and it is eliminating the autonomy of most academics so that their conditions of work more and more are like those of school teachers, except by and large, even more overworked than school teachers and even more on casual contracts than school teachers are. This cost saving and the continued de-skilling of the jobs that most graduates go into has resulted in a dumbing down of university education, from undergraduate education through to PhD studies. Bosses don't want or need, or maybe that should be the other way around, do not need and certainly do not want most of their workers who are graduates to think too critically, let alone to have them encouraged by their education to challenge authority. In the sciences, research is increasingly organised in hierarchical teams with senior managers. Elsewhere, it's subordinated to winning grants from outside funding bodies, which represent the priorities of the state and capital. At the same time, university managements and governments are seeking to eliminate research time for many university teachers and are channeling research into the hands of academic stars who do little or no teaching and whose work matches the whims and priorities of managers, capitalists, and governments. In the social sciences, what that means is that research which comes up with useful suggestions for government policy, the manipulation of workers and consumers by business, as well as arguments which justify the capitalist order and the favourite stances of particular capitalists, capitalist parties and their public institutions. So that's the broad background. And now we're going to hear from Sarah, sinking in her particularly heavy and pointed boot.
Cool. Can I go? Thanks heaps, Rick. It's straight into it. Yeah, it's like there are no walls between us. Okay, so as Rick said, universities exist to serve the interests of the ruling class. They're not neutral institutions. And the same is true of academics. They're not a neutral social layer and they're certainly not free thinkers. The sway of bourgeois ideas is exerted not by the ethereal forces, within the institutions or so on, but actually by people themselves. And it's bourgeois intellectuals, most of whom exist today within the academy, who are the main carriers of bourgeois ideology. And whenever I use the term ideology, for people who aren't familiar with that, it just means lies, the bourgeois lies that exist to justify our society. And as Hal Draper, a US Marxist, put it, the intellectuals under capitalism become carriers of the ideological malady because they are also its deepest diseased victims. So another way of putting that is it is these people, academics, who have drunk the Kool-Aid. And as Marx, or Jerem, quoting Marx last night, put it, the intellectuals believe that they only need to open their mouths and wait for the roast pigeons of absolute knowledge to fly into them. For people in Sydney, sorry, that was a reference to Jerem's speech at our panel last night, but also a quote from Marx about intellectuals. So the role of academics under capitalism is to take up and to develop ideas and concepts in the service of society, which in a society divided by class means in the service of the ruling class. And so to do this, to take up ideas that service society, requires a basic acceptance of the lie that this society is built because of natural impulses and dynamics. It requires an acceptance of the naturalness of capitalism. Now, this doesn't mean that intellectuals defend and propagandize for every single crime of capitalism, but it does mean that all but a small handful will not be able to see society for what it actually is, as a totality built on a set of social relations that are fundamentally unstable and that require the constant use of repression and of ideology to maintain the illusion of any social universality, of any idea of a society. Because academics on the whole cannot see this totality, their contributions will always be limited to fragmentary insights and to the repackaging of bourgeois ideas. So Marx in Capital described the climb down of bourgeois intellectuals after they had fulfilled, their revolutionary role. They were no longer a revolutionary layer in society. And he said of them today, on the level plain, simple mounds look like hills. and the imbecile flatness of the present bourgeoisie is to be measured by the altitude of its great intellects. So how does this process happen of academics, becoming the carriers of the ideological malady? Well, for one thing, the job required of academics is itself based on an ideological commitment to the value of the institution of the university and to the notion that brilliant, learned individuals, i.e. themselves, create new knowledge and will be promoted in their brilliance. And that tie between the daily vocation of academics and the institution that they're a part of makes being an academic very different in terms of the ideological commitment that's inbuilt into it than many other jobs, even though people in other jobs can also be, hold illusions about the industry they work for. It goes much deeper in the case of academics. There's also the question of which projects get funded and which academics get tenure. And in both cases, it will overwhelmingly be those who have some utility for or present no threat to the smooth running of capitalism. So bourgeois conventions and ways of seeing the world through this mechanism will get established and have been established top to bottom across the university. In every single field inside the academy, there are pro-capitalist assumptions. Overpopulation is the predominant way of understanding environmental science and so on. There's also the issue of specialisation. As in other corporations, as in other parts of capitalist society, everything in the university is broken up into individual, supposedly self-contained departments. So you have economics over here, engineering over there, anthropology over here, psychology over there. As if economics has nothing to do with engineering, as if anthropology, the study of human society, has nothing to do with psychology. And so within these discrete disciplines, the pursuit of academic success is often associated with greater and greater specialisation, which takes people into deeper and deeper realms of obscurity. There is an emphasis always on the need to come up with new models and new research. As long as it's new, that's fine, even if it's totally trivial. And because academics are not, for the most part, involved with collective class struggle, that is a process that sheds light on and materially challenges the stability and norms and naturalness of capitalist society, the vast bulk of these new contributions will be trivial. The vast bulk are simply the repackaging of old ideas, or they are so minutely specific that there are virtually no use to anyone. So I think, think of all of the universities in modern capitalism, all of the tens and tens and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands would have been an easier way of saying that, of academics all around the world and performing this mental labour, which in many ways is the equivalent to hundreds of thousands of games of chess being played. It is mental labour, but it has no social purpose. Okay, but clearly, despite these limitations, the academy can at times produce some breakthroughs and can contribute to our understanding of the world. This is particularly the case in the natural sciences, where unlike the humanities and most areas of the social sciences, both breakthroughs and incremental developments in research and understanding are actively promoted because, as Rick talked about, they contribute to the industry and technology of a society governed by capitalist and imperialist competition. So it can be actually quite important to the ongoing dynamism of the system. However, even hard scientific research is marred by the logic and priorities of capitalism. It's set back by that. So take COVID. We could have been actually miles ahead in terms of generating a vaccine if research into this had been properly funded before the current plague hit us. Instead, it was thoroughly downgraded because there was no market incentive. And when the pandemic broke, public university resources were turned over to developing the vaccine. But even so, the process was immediately marketized and was ultimately directed by the pharmaceutical companies competing rather than collaborating with one another. So turning now to the role of academics who work within the humanities and the social sciences. I think the first thing to say about this is the set of departments within the university where the most metaphorical chess playing goes on. As well as that, though, it's also where some of the top ideologues of the system are generated, people who then themselves are part of generating new ideas that are used to justify the system. So you think of Milton Friedman or Francis Fukuyama, and some of these top ideologues become very important state officials. Condoleezza Rice comes from the academy, as did, you know, the esteemed sociology professor Anthony Giddens, who was the advisor to UK Prime Minister Tony Blair. Then there are whole layers within the humanities and social sciences who, as Rick talked about, train young people to be public servants, to be social workers, teachers, nurses, and so on. Now, sometimes within the humanities and social sciences, there is the generation of ideas that are presented as incisive and are about supposedly speaking truth to power. And this happens to an extent because the ruling class can never just rely on repeating the same ancient formulae. They need their ideas to be repackaged, and actually sometimes they need some degree of speaking truth to power to assist them in making profits and competing with their rivals. But speaking truth to power is very different from speaking truth to the working class in the interests of the self-emancipation of the working class and of humanity. So the humanities and the social sciences, even if, you know, you're talking about the times in which there have been, you know, contributions that can be seen to speak truth to power, are not bastions of radical politics and certainly not of radical Marxism, despite what the culture-warring right-wing say. Actually, it's the opposite. Liberalism is the default stance in the Humanities Academy, though there are plenty and plenty of conservative academics as well. And there are many anti-Marxist right-wing ideas that dominate and are taken for granted in anthropology, sociology, philosophy, and so on. So identity politics, effective altruism, the idea that the way to change the world is coming up with improved policies for governments to implement. And actually, some of the most important political attacks on Marxism have come from those lauded as the left-wing academics inside the academy. Now, there have been times when there has been a space opened up, occasional times, within the academy for more left-wing critiques of society. And this has happened because of upticks in the class struggle. And it's important to say that when these upticks in struggle create these spaces, it is very much that what happens inside the academy is a reflection and a tailing of what's happened in the struggle. And that's true both of right-wing and left-wing developments. So there was a big impact as a result of the social upheavals of the revolutions of 1848, the wave of revolutions around World War I and the Great Depression, and there were students in all of those cases, and in particular, I want to underscore, it was students, not, you know, tenured academics, that pushed as a result of those struggles for a more radical and far-sighted, even revolutionary examination of society to be incorporated into their studies. But the period that I want to look at, because it's the most well-known, it's also the most romanticised, and it's the most has the most ongoing relevance for us today, is the period of the 60s and 70s upsurges and the impact that that had on the academy. So as people probably know a little bit, there was a radical upsurge of students in the 1960s. One of the first moments of this was the explosive free speech movement at the University of Berkeley University in California. And this was important because Berkeley University was seen as the pinnacle of this new age, post-war, bureaucratic, expanded model of university that Rick talked about. And that really set the tone. By 68, students were, struggling everywhere. And quickly, these struggles went well beyond the walls of universities. In France, students helped to spark the biggest general strike in history. In Italy and many other countries, students helped to take things to the verge of revolution. And students everywhere were participating in struggles like the anti-war movement and labour struggles too. It was no accident here in Australia that the most radical moment for student rebellion also coincided with the peak of labour militancy. So this wave of revolt was very important throughout society. It wasn't just something that sort of happened in this walled-off way within universities. I think that's one sort of myth that needs to be busted in a way, that often it's just talked about as, you know, these sort of radical centres of students and the impact they had on the university. Their impact went far beyond the university. But going back to the university, there are a few things I want to talk about that kind of illustrate some points about the academy in terms of how they responded to this. So firstly, it's important to say that the existing left academics at the time of this explosion played a thoroughly terrible role in response to it. So many of them actively discouraged student revolt. The most famous case of that was Theodore Adorno, who in 1968, when he was head of his, you know, famous as the leader of the Frankfurt School, and when he was head of his institute in 68, he actually called the police on his students. But as well as individuals playing this kind of reprehensible role, the impact of the existing ideas that had been cultivated within the left academy was very negative. These ideas were mostly Stalinism, but also various strands of Western Marxism. And all of these ideas ended up being very politically disorienting to the student radicals that sort of interpreted them and used them. And they had very little to say actually about the tactics or strategy of struggle. Okay, so then in response to these movements, there was some space and some shift in the terrain of curriculum in humanities and social sciences in particular. But I think it's important to say that this was not automatic. The universities did not just respond to these movements by absorbing the great ideas that were being thrown up by the Black Rights Movement, by the Women's Movement, and say, yep, come on in, we'll build academic departments around this. So one case study is a useful illustration of what the actual dynamic was, which was that at Sydney University in the early 70s, two postgrad students campaigned to get a unit established called Philosophical Aspects of Feminist Thought. And this unit was initially approved by the Faculty of Arts, but the professor of philosophy at the time was outraged when he heard. He got onto the vice chancellor, who then refused to offer any funding to the subject. And he then went to the professorial board that voted resoundingly against this subject on the explicit grounds that they didn't support the teaching of feminist philosophy. Meanwhile, the students outside were gaining more and more support for their proposal. They began a month-long occupation on the quad lawn at Sydney University, which they called the Women's Embassy as a sort of tribute to the Aboriginal Tent Embassy. And more importantly than just having this student occupation, the Builders Labourers Federation put a green ban on Sydney University, refusing to continue any work on any buildings. And under this pressure, Sydney University gave in and the course was established, laying the basis for the later establishment of the Women's Studies Department. So as well as this kind of process, it's important to say that I think there was an element that after not just the wave of struggles, but also the end of the long boom that ended with the crash in 73, there was somewhat a need to kind of reconfigure the ethos and ideology of certain social sciences in order to reflect a society that was much more conflict-driven and so on than the kind of glowy, glossy idea, you know, golden age kind of the post-war boom. So some of the ways in which sociology in particular was amended in the 70s reflected this reality of a much more troubled capitalist order. Okay, so as well, another impact that happened as a result of this upsurge of struggle on the academy was that many of the student activists were recruited into it, and they joined, they made their way from being junior academics up into the lofty heights and becoming some of the most sort of left figures of the famous left figures of the academy throughout the 80s and the 90s and so on. This was a tragedy because pretty much all of these people were simultaneously lost to the revolutionary movement as a result of their prioritisation of the academy and also their material existence within this academy that I described the process of. Their politics invariably shifted to the right, towards reformism, towards liberal eclecticism, and many of them actually flipped to the right. So I'm going to look quickly at the effect of the decline of the struggle and where all of the Marxist thinkers that went into the academy went. So firstly, there was the current of vehemently anti-Marxist new philosophers, a current begun in France in the 1970s by embittered 68 radicals. And this was emblematic of the general trend that would continue into post-structuralism and post-modernism. There was also in this vein members of the RCP, the Revolutionary Communist Party, clique around Frank Furuti, including Munira Mirza, director of Number 10 Policy Unit. Look her up, an absolute sobering tale of a former leftist gone very bad. There were the Anglo-Marxists. They were into social scientific Marxism and saw it as important to take political positions, but they became increasingly divorced from any political practice. And their positions also lacked any unifying theoretical or philosophical framework. So many of them, and these are in particular people around the New Left Review, slid further and further towards reformism. There were also the Althusserian currents. Althusser predates this mid-70s generation of left academics, but his ideas took hold then. In particular, the assertion that history is a process without a subject and the concept of theoretical practice, the perfect rationale for ivory tower leftism. Most Althusserians then evolved into being postmodernists, and, you know, that's the case still, even though there's been a kind of recent revival of Althusserianism. Others mutated into postmodernists too. Their endpoint was liberalism in a postmodernist guise, so Foucault, Derrida, all of these, their politics were from this point on built around a rejection of any systemic explanation of society and any orientation to the working class as a revolutionary subject. Postmodernism and its cousins, post-structuralism and post-Marxism, were a ghoulish manifestation of the retreat of struggle and the birth of neoliberalism. Humanities academics now declared that everything was meaningless, only symbols matter. And in turn, that symbols only matter insofar as they are nodal points, which can have multiple meanings in the terms of Laclau and Mouffe. The influence of postmodernism stretched from cultural philosophy to politics, infusing every subject. It really was a complete reversion to liberalism, and it fitted nicely with the structurally inbuilt eclecticism and obscurantism of the academy. Neoclassical economics also has made greater and greater inroads into the social sciences. The phenomenon of economics imperialism has meant that the assumptions of neoclassical economics have increasingly influenced all subjects within the social sciences. So the underlying assumption of many subjects today is that human beings are essentially individual beings driven by immutable forces. And today it's not unusual to find units like a philosophy unit that many of my comrades or a couple of my comrades have had the misfortune of studying at Melbourne Uni, which is called the Ethics of Capitalism, which is all about the philosophical virtues of the free market. So today, postmodernism is not actively pushed. Its bloated corpse, however, still reeks in many academic departments. And the reason it's not actively pushed is that it's done its job. There is no attempt or necessity to theorise the lack of theory. There's just no theory. So much of the Arts Academy is now geared to policy rather than any attempt, even distorted attempt, to fundamentally criticise how society works. And the contributions of these left academics have completely faded from the public discourse. There are hardly any of them today. Where are all these Marxists? Where are all of these left academics? The next thing that me and Rick want to do is to look at a couple of them who are still alive and kicking and what they actually represent. So I'm going to start with Noam Chomsky. Okay, so Noam Chomsky, very famous, and his influential article from 50 years ago about the social responsibility of intellectuals actually makes several good points. One of them is the rejection of the idea that speaking truth to power is in any way useful. It actually argues that the search for truth is an unending and mass collective process. But despite that, he has increasingly made moderate, increasingly moderate liberal arguments. The most latest kind of, I guess, like betrayal of his sort of left-wing grassroots roots in a way is his enthusiastic support for both Clinton and Biden. But more than this, there's actually always been a contradiction between Chomsky's reputation as a radical anti-war liberal and his strong history of defending his institution of employment, MIT. MIT is one of the foremost military research institutions in the world. It basically works directly for the Pentagon. Yet Chomsky has consistently been on the wrong side of student and staff campaigns throughout his entire time that he was there. As early as 1969, in response to a student campaign to shut down the military facilities, he opposed that and said that instead they should be campaigning to restrict to research on systems of a purely defensive character. He has also refused to condemn the university for repression of student protesters and has lent support to consecutive right-wing presidents of the university and has supported the appointment and ongoing employment of hard-right militarist academics. Over to you, Rick.
Unlike Noam Chomsky, the geographer David Harvey calls himself a Marxist, and he is probably one of, if not the best-known academic Marxists in the world, largely for his popularisation of ideas in Marx's Capital. But he began his Marxist career as a geographer, and he certainly made contributions there that are worth reading. And in our denunciations of academia, and especially of the academic left, neither Sarah nor I want to say, just write them off, don't read anything about by these people. There's a temptation to do that, but we're not doing that. And the same is actually true of some right-wing writers and academics. It is possible to derive useful information from all sorts of sources and even inspiration or idea sparks from reading all sorts of things. The crucial thing is to read dialectically, to understand where the author is coming from, who they are addressing, who their intended audience is, which material interests they are advancing, the context in which they write, when they wrote, and what came before, what their intentions are, but beyond their intentions, what the effects of their writings are. These are important things when you read anything, including TV commercials, but also any kind of a text, and especially an academic text put before you by some wet liberal or conservative course convener. So Harvey's stuff on geography is certainly worth reading and has a Marxist bent. But in a profound way, he has little in common with the real Marxist tradition. What is the real Marxist tradition? I think it was Lenin who said that Marxism is the theory and practice of proletarian revolution. That is the core of the Marxist tradition. That means the working class emancipating itself through revolution, not revolution as a general idea, but through insurrection, the use of working class force and working class power. I'd now like to read you a little quote from David Harvey from his podcast, a podcast last year. Capital in general is too big to fail. It is too dominant and it is too necessary to us that we cannot allow it to fail. We have to actually spend some time propping it up. Sorry, I've lost my spot. Trying to reorganise it and maybe shift it around very slowly and over time to a different configuration, presumably. Nice capitalism, which is what most people who call themselves socialists today want, especially those who identify themselves as social democrats or democratic socialists. Socialism means nice capitalism. That's an interpolation. Harvey goes on, but a revolutionary overthrow of this capitalist economic system is not anything that's conceivable. At the present time, it will not happen, it cannot happen, and we have to make sure that it does not happen. Now, we've got to realise that most of the people who identify as Marxists today have little or nothing to do with the real Marxist tradition of working class self-emancipation through mass revolution. They're Stalinists, they're social democrats, they have ideas that are alien to the notion of self-emancipation. Where do correct ideas come from? To quote from a very, very famous self-proclaimed Marxist, Chairman Mao, who wasn't a Marxist at all in any sense. He was a counter-revolutionary in a fundamental way. Marxism is the scientific study of human societies in order to change them. It is not an objective activity. Just as any study of society cannot be objective. They all have an agenda, whether it is conscious in the minds of the writer or the researcher or unconscious. They all have an agenda. We have an agenda that is working class revolution, and that provides a basis for looking through the ideologies that justify the established order. It provides a basis for understanding the underlying logic below the surface appearances, the self-camouflage or the fetishism of commodities, if you like, of capitalist society. The preservation of the real Marxist tradition after the midnight of the century, the rise of Stalinism and fascism, did not occur primarily in universities, although that's the circumstance in which so-called Western Marxism emerged. Marx and Engels, unlike Hegel, were never professors. Theory was not just abstract thought, but also engagement in struggle. Marx and Engels and those who took Marxist theory forward as the theory and practice of proletarian revolution were revolutionary activists themselves who connected with workers' struggles, and that was the key to their intellectual breakthroughs. Living Marxism is about political engagement, not just having correct ideas. And effective political engagement and the development of Marxism as a guide to understanding the world in order to change it is not a solo activity. It cannot be undertaken in the comfort of your academic office. It is something that can only be effectively undertaken in the context of mass struggles and engagement, involvement in those mass struggles. It requires organisations committed not just to improving the world, but fundamentally to changing it by and for the vast majority which is exploited and oppressed and has an interest in that change.
Thanks, comrades. There was some excellent points and venting in that discussion. So a couple of things to pick up on. Nicole talked about the sort of very dominant trend of class collaborationism between academic staff and their superiors. And that, I think, is quite important. And it's something that I remember reading an article recently that it wasn't until the 80s and 90s that the idea that the sort of managers of the university should not be incorporated into the trade unions and not be seen as just part of the collegiate kind of cohort of people all working to make the university a better educational institute was, became a reality. And it really took managers being appointed who came directly from the business community for that to happen. And even still, there's a real problem with it. So, you know, my old university, UNSW, it was so in your face. You know, they had someone appointed to the board who his last job had been as the head of a mine in Botswana. so no educational credentials whatsoever, pure manager. But still, there's this idea that, you know, we're all here working towards the betterment of society through education. So that is something that at a practical level, our comrades have to work to break down who work within that trade union, because there is, on the other hand, the constant proletarianisation going on inside universities. That means that there are opportunities for struggle, but there are those political arguments that need to be waged. Something I want to talk about, Emma mentioned the division between the division of labour between intellectual activity and physical labour, I guess. I think that's important. And one of the things that capitalism necessitated was the creation of a layer of intellectuals. And this isn't to say that there weren't people approximating this in societies prior to capitalism. There were scholars, clerics, and so on. But capitalism has a much more dynamic need for a constant sort of renewal of intellectual theories and ideas to justify the system for a whole series of reasons. And so it necessitated the creation of this layer of intellectuals. And it's important to say that precisely because of that, well before you even get to the question of the academy that institutionalizes these people, intellectuals just free-floating in society without any connection, as Emma talked about, to, you know, making art themselves or doing politics themselves, just being a scientist of politics. It's such a ridiculous concept. And it's corrupting. It's why Engels called the intellectual layer in society, the intelligentsia, the most venal of all social layers. And that has to be our starting point, because as a layer that's generated in society, they have no reason in and of themselves to play a positive part in actually the kind of struggles that will transform the world. And inbuilt into them as a layer is idealism and all the things people have talked about. However, we are for intellectual activity and, you know, rigorous intellectual pursuits within our own movement. And we are also for dragging people out of these created layers, the intelligentsia, and into our movement. And that's important. And it's not the case that every intellectual who gives themselves over to the labor movement will necessarily betray all of the social pressures that come with being an intellectual. Many within the reformist labour movement around the Second International, you know, maintained many of the elitist ideas and so on that also came from their role as an intellectual. But for the revolutionary subsection of the labour movement, its capacity to draw intellectuals out of their, you know, purported social role of producing ideas in the service of capitalist society was to get people to betray their class and to, you know, give their services to our movement. And that was important. But so too was the building up of intellectuals from below, building up, you know, a movement. The socialist movement is rigorously intellectual. It demands theory. We can't just go out into the streets and agitate. We have to understand this whole complex society and then all of the layers of subterfuge, obscurantism and so on that are ideologically put on top of that. We have to understand all of that because we have given ourselves the task of trying to dismantle all of that. So I think that's important to say that intellectuals within our movement are important and they're not some privileged subset. They are part of and integrated into, and all of us should be striving to be as intellectually serious about the tasks we've set ourselves, as well as getting out into the streets and putting our, you know, putting our money where our mouth is and all of that. And I think, you know, following on from that is the point that, yeah, in contrast to that, after World War II, those who were seen as left academics were mostly those who were institutionalized within the academy, and their interventions and their attempts to try to build on the great body of work that is Marxism were mostly corrupt. Whereas all of the best intellectual contributions that have been made to Marxism, it didn't start and end with Marx. It's been built on since then. And it's been built on by people who have been intimately engaged with the struggle and intimately connected to building revolutionary parties. So you think of state and revolution, you think of the theoretical breakthroughs about how to understand imperialism, think in the 70s of the theoretical breakthroughs from our movement about how to understand women's oppression and other forms of oppression. And most importantly, the theoretical and political breakthroughs in terms of how to understand the project of party building. So I think it's important to say that, yeah, there has been a rich intellectual tradition in our movement. But it comes out of combating all of the social pressures and all of the bullshit assumptions that exist within the sphere of bourgeois intelligentsia.
Well, inspired by Anna, I want to reinforce a number of the messages that have come through today from the floor and in Sarah's concluding remarks. I want to make a confession. I was a teenage Althusserian. And I was, for 27 years, a tenured academic. But where was my real education? Where did I really grow to understand how the world worked and how I could make a contribution to making the world a better place, and not just making the world a better place in a Band-Aid sort of a way, but towards building a revolutionary current in Australia? That wasn't through the courses that I took as an undergraduate, an honours student and as a PhD student, or even my PhD research. That was through engagement from 1977 onward with a predecessor of Socialist Alternative and subsequently with Socialist Alternative itself, through involvement in an organisation that was committed to understand the world in order to change it. Involvement with other people who had other experiences, who had other knowledge that I could learn from and put into practice. And that's enabled me to be on some occasions a reasonably effective activist and in some occasions quite a leading activist. That is not something that I would have gained by purely concentrating on my academic activities. So I enjoin all of you who may be early on in their careers and their studies not to aspire to be John Wycliffe with his cushy job at Oxford and his high aristocratic mates. I don't want you to be hung, drawn and quartered, but I think a much better model is John Ball, somebody who argued, who organised and who fought, who wanted to change the world, but unfortunately in that feudal society, the scope for the peasants' revolt to be successful was, well, not just limited, but non-existent. In this society today, the scope for the workers' revolt to be successful is enormous, and we can make a contribution to making it successful.